from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Air pollution prematurely kills some 7 million people around the world and more than 100,000 Americans a year. That's according to environmental journalist Beth Gardner. Her new book is called Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution, and in it she travels the world from China to the San Joaquin Valley to understand how political and economic forces have an impact on our air quality. And she joins us this segment to discuss the current state of air pollution, the legacy of the 1970 U.S. Clean Air Act, and what needs to happen next to ensure a cleaner future. And we welcome you, Beth Gardner. Good to have you.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'd like to begin with health, because we're all aware of the fact that lung cancer and health problems are related to the air we breathe. We're all aware of the fact, at least most of us are, that there are vulnerable populations, the elderly and children and people who have various kinds of lung problems or whatever, and that health and neurodevelopment are very tied to, intrinsically tied to the air we breathe. But I suppose what we're learning more about now is, and some studies being done right here at UC San Francisco about IQ development in children and the air we breathe.
Yeah, you know, I think what really brought me to this story of air pollution and to working on this book was my own sort of shock when I began a few years back to read a little bit some of the science of what air pollution does to our bodies, because, you know, it is very stunning. As you say, I think we are all sort of pretty prepared to believe that, you know, asthma and other breathing problems might be connected to air pollution. But it is actually so much wider than that. As you say, there are significant cognitive effects. Air pollution can
harm the development of the brain, actually.
Yep, can trigger and accelerate dementia in older people. Cardiovascular effects, strokes, heart attacks go up the longer you're exposed to dirty air, even at pretty, you know, moderate levels. And, you know, once I began to understand this, I'm a journalist, and that really struck me as a big and important story that we weren't really sort of hearing enough about. And it's not just the range of illnesses linked to air pollution that are shocking, but the numbers that are linked to it. You know, once you start digging into this issue, you come across these really, you know, alarming statistics. 7 million people every year dying from the effects of air pollution prematurely. More than 100,000 Americans in the UK, where I live, 40,000 people every year. And there's this sort of invisibility that means that we don't perceive that. You know, if I lose someone tomorrow, or if I have a heart attack or get sick, I'll never know it's because of air pollution. But this is really having a powerful effect on us. So what I kind of wanted to do in telling this story is to try to make that a little bit more visible.
Well, in fact, in some respects, I suppose it is invisible, because it doesn't necessarily kill people directly. That's, I think, implicit in what you've just said. It's not as if people can make that cause and effect link and say, there it is, you know. It's palpable.
Exactly. Well, it's interesting. On an individual basis, it's normally almost impossible to ever say, you know, you got sick or, you know, someone died because of air pollution. But at what they call a population level, across a city or region or a country, large groups of people, the science is very, very rigorous that when levels of pollution go up, more people die. So these excess deaths are, you know, very much directly attributable to the pollution that we're putting into the air, but on a sort of individual basis, it's hard to perceive it.
And today is a Clean Air Act day. Excuse me.
Spare the Air.
Spare the Air Day. Yeah, thank you. How much do these Spare the Air Days really help? Or do they obviously help to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, these things can be meaningful if they trigger, you know, people to maybe carpool or take public transportation instead of drive, or actually wood-burning fires are a big contributor to particulate pollution. So if Spare the Air kicks in some restrictions on that, it can help improve air quality. But really, this problem is so much bigger than that, you know, and it's very much intertwined with the challenge we face now in confronting climate change, because they both really boil down to the same root cause, which is fossil fuels, the foundation we built our modern world on. And we all know it's, you know, those fuels are warming our planet and creating this climate crisis. But I think fewer of us maybe understand that those fuels are actually making us sick right now, too.
Yeah, it's not only the carbon, but I always want to emphasize it's the methane and many other things, too, that are part of the whole picture. When you talk about starting, well, fires, for example, I mean, we're very concerned about wildfires right now here in California, but there are some instructions and some tips that have to do with really making the air cleaner for you and not contributing to making the air more polluted. One of them is just simply not lighting a fire at your home. People like, you know, the hearth of the fire and all that sort of thing, but it should be eschewed to a great degree. But also, there are some things that I wanted to touch on with you because you point them out here. One is, the help of that comes from changing travel and exercise routes. This is major because the differences are extraordinary. You get pollution levels that can vary about 8 times as much in the space of a single block. So if people are doing exercises, they really want to measure and quantify as best they can what they're doing in terms of their breathing.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, we as individuals cannot change the quality of the air that surrounds us. You know, this is a responsibility that needs to be met by our political leaders and by regulators to make the changes that will actually get the air cleaner. But in the meantime, there are some things that we can do as individuals to try to reduce our own exposure. And yeah, I mean, that was something that sort of surprised me, that actually the route that you take, and I walk a lot, the route that you take, whether you're walking or biking or actually even driving, can make a big difference to your exposure. So air pollution scientists now are very interested in this idea of sort of micro environments. You know, air quality is not just one number across an entire city or region, but it's sort of what, you know, millions of individual people breathe as they go about their day. And it turns out that even something as small as walking on, you know, a parallel road rather than walking on a really busy traffic-clogged street, if you go, if there is an option, one street over, a block away, to walk on a quieter route, that can actually reduce your exposure by as much as half.
And you can monitor this, and it can make a big difference, whether you're riding a bike, as you say, or walking or whatever.
Yeah, there's a whole new generation now of these handheld portable monitors, and you can see what your own exposure is.
I also recommend buying an air purifier, especially useful here in the West.
Right. So obviously, the thing with planning your route is related to traffic exhaust, traffic pollution. That's not going to help you with wildfire smoke, which has become a huge issue here in California and across the West in terms of air quality as these fires are getting more intense and the fire season is getting longer. You know, there's sort of mixed evidence around masks and how helpful they are, you know, particularly because the fit is often not right. But it does seem that air purifiers in the home can make a difference.
Especially isn't the HEPA one, is that?
Yeah, that seems to be the most recommended one, and it's a good idea to make sure that you're sort of reading the instructions and using the purifier for the right size room that it's intended for.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, we were talking about the Endangered Species Act of 1975 in the last segment. 1970 was the Clean Air Policy Act, and it had a great deal of impact and still does. But things have been kind of tossed up and tossy-turned in that vein as well, haven't they, here in the United States?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, actually, the U.S., if you look globally, is a real example of success and progress when it comes to air quality. Since 1970, in California and all across the country, the air is so much cleaner than it was. That is thanks in large part to the Clean Air Act of 1970. It was updated and strengthened in 1990, and also to the enforcement power that the EPA has brought in sort of making this law into a reality on the ground.
So not necessarily making America great again in terms of what we're breathing now.
Yeah. So what we've started to see over the last couple of years now in the Trump administration is a real aggressive rollback of these regulations under the Clean Air Act that have delivered so much progress and literally have saved. This is from, you know, government analysis, millions of American lives and trillions of dollars since 1970. So we're, you know, at a real danger of going backwards now. And I think, you know, we hear a lot about the rollbacks, but I think actually the most radical element of what the Trump administration is doing is not really a specific action on any one particular regulation, but it's a real assault on science. Because science has been the strength and really the bedrock of both the Clean Air Act and the Environmental Protection Agency. And there's been a real effort now in the last couple of years by industry and by the administration and by Republicans in Congress as well, to try to discredit some of this very, very rigorous science that has demonstrated very powerfully the links between air pollution and danger to health.
Which again connects us to what we just spoke of about the Endangered Species Act in the last segment. We're talking to Beth Gardner. She's an environmental journalist. She's also the author of Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. And she's going to be appearing at the Kaper Center in Oakland tomorrow night, Wednesday, on the 14th of August at 3 p.m. And in the meantime, if you have questions for her or comments, if you simply like to join this conversation, we welcome your involvement in the program. You can join us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement in the program, so please feel free to call. Again, the number 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. Here's Ben, who asks, are you concerned about the conflating of trees' ability to sequester carbon dioxide with their potential to remove air pollutants permanently? It seems like there is a public perception that planting trees automatically reduces air pollution, whereas some research suggests this relationship is quite complicated.
I think trees are great. Planting trees is definitely a good thing to do environmentally. It benefits both the climate and I think it benefits air quality as well.
It does,
I haven't seen any evidence of complicating factors there. But, you know, really the way to deal with this, whether you're talking about climate or sort of local air quality and the health effects, is to address the emissions and for us to put out less pollution. California, by the way, has been, you know, a leader on this nationally and globally as well.
We know. We take great pride in that. And it does often boil down to policies and regulations and what the politicians are doing and holding their feet to the fire. I think you make that point very explicit in your work. Where are politicians doing it really well? You've traveled the globe. Where are they getting ahead of the curve here in terms of air pollution?
Well, you know, as I said,
California, aside from California.
One place that I went to for my research was Berlin. Their air is not fabulous, but they have been making some real strides in terms of incentivizing alternative forms of transportation and helping people to get out of their cars. And that probably holds some lessons for California, and I know that it's something that a lot of cities in this state are trying to do now as well, because electric cars are great and they certainly emit fewer pollutants than gas or diesel cars. But ultimately, we do need fewer cars on the road because the millions and millions that are, you know, out there right now sitting in traffic and spewing out that stuff are, you know, a big part of this problem. So in Berlin, you know, what you see, first of all, is absolutely fantastic public transportation. You know, it's a real baseline requirement, I think, for helping people to letting people get out of their cars. But they're also experimenting with a lot of, you know, other approaches to transportation, whether it's sort of, you know, carpooled type of things that you can call up on an app on your phone, or these shared electric bikes and scooters, et cetera. So I think that's a place that is, you know, trying to do things a little bit differently.
Rush hour is the worst for pollution, obviously. So timing becomes a very important part, not only in terms of the public transportation you use, but with respect to your own transportation. But I also learned from you that air quality is worse in the morning because of something that I hadn't even come across in any of my reading, temperature inversion.
Yeah, well, it depends where you are, actually, and this doesn't happen every day and it doesn't happen in every place. But temperature inversion is a phenomenon where you have a layer of hot air. The air sort of flips.
And the pollution gets trapped.
Exactly, and the pollution gets held in place. So, you know, the emissions that we're producing don't sort of blow away. So I think that sort of, you know, flags this point that when you're trying to think about reducing your own exposure, sort of, you know, having the knowledge and informing yourself and understanding what your local conditions are is really important.
We're talking again with Beth Gardner. I'm going to go to your calls, but I have to ask you, Beth, masks?
Masks are sort of a mixed bag. You know, one scientist I spoke to who'd done a lot of testing on them said, you know, it's not that they're worthless. They can help. But don't think you're totally protected, you know, if there's a wildfire and there's a lot of smoke where you are.
Because they don't exactly seal your face
Lot of these masks, actually, what the scientists find is that they work really great in the lab, but out in the real world, you're moving around and, you're talking or whatever, and you get gaps in the side of your face, and then the air just comes in. So it's sort of a mixed verdict on masks.
We'll bring our callers aboard here. And Ariane, you're first. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to make an analogy. When all those years when the tobacco companies and the pesticide companies denied the impact on human health when people were smoking, we're in a time when we're all smokers now. We're all having these situations imposed on us. And we need to be understanding that there's an actual war going on over our planet. And what the problem is that we're addicted to fossil fuels. That's part of the reason why we're not more active, I think. We're implicated. And I would really want to question the approach that we just need to make lifestyle changes. Lifestyle solutions are not sufficient when our house is on fire. And we really need to come from a different point of view, simplify our lives, and understand that America is using 25% of the world resources and all the trash and the exhaust and the waste that we produce from our military to our corporations. It's in the air, it's in the water, and we are narcissistic. It's not just our president who is emblematic of that. The way we treat the planet is a sign of our lack of consciousness and a selfish approach to our environment.
Well, I thank you for those sentiments and expressing them. I want to comment on what you just said, Beth Gardner?
The analogy to the tobacco companies is one that you hear a lot when it comes to particularly the fossil fuel industry and also the auto industry. And I think that gets back to something we were talking about earlier, which is this sort of effort to, attack and undermine the science, which was obviously the hallmark of the tobacco companies pretending for so long that there was no link between smoking and cancer.
Lying.
Yeah, we see the same thing happening very often now when it comes to climate change and also, as I said earlier, to air pollution. And as to the caller's other point about behavioral change, I think that's absolutely right. It's great to talk about, how we can reduce our exposure and buying an air purifier for your house. And it's great for people to think about how they can reduce their own contribution to pollution. But these are really, such small things compared to the actual sort of systemic change that is needed. And whether you're talking about climate change or air pollution and health, it is really only our governments that can make the changes that are needed. And I think that one thing that the success of the 1970 Clean Air Act, which, by the way, was a bipartisan piece of legislation, one thing that shows us is that when the government does actually exert its authority to impose regulation on polluting companies, polluting industries, and make them clean up, it actually works. The auto industry was, one of the most recalcitrant industries for so long. They still are in many ways. But that law back in 1970 told them, you need to do things better. And actually, thanks to that legislation, the cars that we drive today are 99% cleaner than models that were being produced back in 1970. And that's a big part of why our air is so much cleaner. There's way more of them on the roads, so. Yeah,
there's also much more to do about emissions, too. We still have some big mountains to climb. But
there's a long way to go, but I think the point is that when government steps up and does its job, it works. Regulation has been very effective in dealing with air pollution over the last 50 years.
Here's Justin. Justin, you're on. Morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Right now, with the California housing crisis, the state is forcing cities to build high-density, mixed-use, walkable cities. But we're just adding more cars to the road. And the reason is that our workforce here in the Bay Area, especially, is just so fluid. Nobody works at jobs longer than 3 years before moving on to another one. And so even if we did have a better public transportation, it's just impossible to identify where the work centers are. And so they're just adding more cars to the road by building these high-density developments. And I'll listen to the air.
Yeah, Justin makes, I think, a fair point there. Some thoughts from you, Beth Gardner?
Yeah, well, I mean, high density can be beneficial if it means that people don't have to drive to get where they're going.
Exactly.
But, you know, it requires good planning, requires effective local zoning decisions and, you know, sort of land use planning. And if that's not done wisely, then you end up with exactly what Justin was saying, which is,
we used to call it smart growth.
More cars,
was the language that we used to use about this. I mean, it has to be all factored in. But he has, I think, a very valid point.
Right, because if you build things in a way that the only way that people can get places is to drive, then you can't really ask them not to drive.
Then you got more drivers, unless you have, of course, the access to public transportation.
Exactly.
But here's a listener who says, there are two restaurants who burn wood in their ovens on Piedmont Avenue in Oakland. The whole street smells like a campsite. Why do restaurants not have to follow spare-the-air restrictions? I have asthma. It's ridiculous. We'll put that out there for any policymakers who may be listening in Piedmont, which is in the East Bay. Here's Rich, who writes, the approach by the Bay Area Air Quality Management District is more show than real action. They go after stationary diesel engine equipment with a vengeance. However, they only warn homeowners using their fireplaces on spare-the-air days. Fireplaces and two-cycle engines, like leaf blowers, put out far more particulate matter than a large modern diesel engine. And again, a good point.
Yeah, well, you know, the role of wood burning is actually really pretty significant in local air quality. And it's funny because it was something that I had trouble taking seriously for a long time. I would say it was about three quarters of the way through my several years of research for this book before I started to really get that wood was a serious problem.
But
I knew
about particulate matter.
Sure,
didn't you?
I think I was very ready to believe that, you know, coal is toxic, but wood has this aura around it of being sort of natural and cozy. Who doesn't love to, you know, curl up in front of the fireplace, right? But it's actually, you know, very thick in PM 2.5, these tiny particulates that go very deep into our bodies, and it carries all kinds of carcinogens and other toxins too. And a lot of times wood is sort of optional. You know, it's a lifestyle thing, an aesthetic. Just we light a fire in our fireplace just for pleasure, not really because we have to. So it's actually a pretty easy win to just not do that. Another thing about wood burning is that it's been sort of sold and portrayed in many places as environmentally friendly, as carbon neutral. And this is a sort of green way you can, you know, instead of natural gas for your home heat or whatever. That really is not true, unfortunately. It requires very, very sort of perfect conditions, for which rarely actually pan out, for it to actually be carbon neutral. And we do know that the health effects are, you know, very real.
Talking with Beth Gardner, environmental journalist, author of Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. And we're joined next by Declan. Declan, join us. Hi.
Hello. So I'm a youth environmental activist in the Bay Area, and my question for you is, how can electric cars help improve, like, Bay Area air quality?
Electric cars are great. You know, they're definitely putting out less emissions than a traditional fossil fuel car in terms of the stuff that we breathe. They're better in terms of climate change as well, assuming that the electricity that they're, you know, being powered by is coming from some sort of renewable source. But, you know, I think if we just replaced every gasoline car out on the road with an electric car, that is not really the answer to anything, because we're still, you know, putting a tremendous load onto our electrical grid system. There's particulates that come from the wear on the tires and the brakes that is still not great. And there's a, you know, tremendous environmental burden that comes from all the materials that are needed to make the cars, the batteries and all of that. So I think electric cars can certainly be part of the solution, both on climate and air quality. But fewer cars really has to be, you know, part of the plan, too. And that requires some bigger picture thought on the part of our policymakers.
Well, our policymakers need to think of clean air regulations, federal standards that have teeth to them, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we're seeing a real sort of tug of war going on now between Sacramento and Washington, particularly vis-a-vis regulations on automakers. As you know, California has some special powers, this waiver, because it was the only state to already be regulating auto emissions before the Clean Air Act became law in 1970.
We just did a deal with four of the big automakers, in fact, a separate deal.
Exactly. So California has always sort of had this role of kind of trying to drag the rest of the country along behind it in terms of air quality and now climate change as well. And it's turned into a, you know, big battle now with Washington as the Trump administration is trying to revoke that waiver.
Let me bring another caller on, and that's Gavin. You're on. Morning.
Good morning. My comment is that when the electric scooters were introduced in San Francisco, there were huge amounts of electric scooters, and it was really great. And then the city came along and decided to restrict the amount of companies that could place electric scooters and restrict the amount of scooters that each company could place. And the same thing happened in Sacramento, where I live. There's restrictions on not just which companies can place them, but how many vehicles that they can put out there. And it seems really counterproductive because it seems like if your city is littered with cheap, efficient, environmentally friendly last-mile transportation options, that's not really a bad thing.
Yeah, and it's not just San Francisco. I think this has been an issue in a lot of cities across the country and, indeed, around the world. Now that these sort of bikes, electric scooters, these sharing, this sharing economy sort of approach to transportation, there's a question of how do you manage the scooters or the bikes? And there is an issue of, you know, them being littered around. I think this is an area where there's been a lot of growth without necessarily the necessary planning to go along with it. But, you know, I think when you actually sort of open your eyes and look in our cities at how much space and how much sort of primacy we give to cars, you know, it's barely anything actually that we're giving to bikes and scooters and all of that. But people sort of feel it and perceive the, you know, problems with those kinds of vehicles more because we're not used to it. We're just 100% accustomed to, you know, giving people parking space and letting roads kind of define our cities. And now that we're looking at other approaches and alternatives, it feels like an encroachment. And for sure, there's, I think, some issues that need to be worked out there.
For sure.
But there's a balance to be struck as well.
I want to thank Gavin for the call and go to a listener question. This listener writes, are there studies that have evaluated the effect of exhaust and lead on long-term health?
Yeah, well, lead is certainly very well known to be a neurotoxin. It has an effect on particularly children, on their cognitive development and on IQ. But as far as long-term effects of air pollution, yeah, this is something that's very well understood now. And, you know, even breathing pretty moderate levels of pollution over many years is going to have serious effects for you over the course of your life.
And that includes exhaust, which is also what the listener wanted to know about.
Absolutely, yes.
Beth, good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us, this segment of Forum, and congratulations on your book, and good luck with it. You can actually meet Beth Gardner. She'll be appearing at Capers Center in Oakland tomorrow afternoon, actually, at 3 p.m. Pardon?
It's been great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, thank you. Again, the book is called Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and you can count on the fact that there's another hour repeated in the evening at 10 to 11, and hope you can also count on the fact that we'll be back with you on tomorrow. Thanks for being with us today and for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.